Toronto and listeners of the show from
around the world.
Oh, yeah. All reaches, all little nooks and crannies. Somehow, you know, like, I've had listeners reach out from Australia, obviously, after I've...
Well, because you're a big AFL fan.
Yeah, even before that, though. And I've had people reach out from California, from southern states, Tennessee. There's just Leaf fans out there. There's people who are from here or have roots here that are all over the world, right? They're all over the world. And they want a little slice of home. And what is more a slice of home than tuning into something that is going to discuss the Maple Leafs disappointing you? Like, honestly, you must feel the most at home. It's a nice warm blanket around you. You
tucked in your own little bed.
you woke up this morning or whatever time it is, and you said, "I just want to feel home." And here we come with the blanket of Leafs depression to wrap around you and hold you close. It's the Fan Morning Show. I'm JD Bunkus, Ailish Porfar, Blake Murphy. Quite a weekend. This is a weird show, right? Because the Leafs win on Friday night in pretty spectacular and entertaining fashion, and then they get absolutely thumped last night. I'm trying not to be too negative today, but it's also hard not to be too negative today. I don't know where to begin.
Well, here's where we begin. The big cliffhanger at the end of last week's show was, can JD pull off the Zach Morris? Can he evade AC Slater blowing up his spot with Jesse Spano and Kelly Kapowski? Can he do the two dates at once and successfully attend a wedding and watch Game 3 of Leafs Lightning?
Yeah.
If this had instead been about Game 4, it's a very, very easy, quick story. The show is canceled. It doesn't make past pilot. Eight minutes into Game 4, you're home free. You're just staying at the wedding. But Game 3 was a barn burner. Did you pull it off?
Okay, so let me just start with this. I had a listener send this tweet that said the wedding should have been yesterday, and I actually had a laugh. And I said, you know what? This is a good reason to have Twitter, is a joke like that, you know, a communication with somebody like that, because you're right. I very much wish that was the case. The only thing that I will make the counter to it was getting to do the rewatch Saturday completely hungover. And then to have two Blue Jays games was actually about as good of a hangover day as I've had. Like, I got to watch the Leafs with the comfort of knowing the end result, and those two Blue Jays games, although, I don't know, we'll get to that later too, is mixed results there as well. I did not really pull it off. This is kind of how it went down. There was a lot of buzz. The wedding started early. It was like 5 o'clock when the ceremony starts. It's downtown. I actually did a hit on Real Kipper and Bourne right before that, and I'm kind of I'm on Queen Street, and I'm trying to run around to avoid
a little buzz going.
Well, no, I had no buzz at this point. There was no buzz. I was just I listen. I've never done radio hits buzzed up. Ayla's trying to get me fired, but that's okay. But I'm walking around the Queen Street trying to find like a little bit of refuge from the noise, because there's, you know, the usual Queen Street sounds, right? I finish the hit, we start the wedding, it gets done. And I did the scouting report as I'm on the phone with Real Kipper and Bourne. I'm looking for a bar that's close to this place. There wasn't really anything within a few minutes walk, at least, within my radius. There was nothing where the game would have been playing. Like, I'm talking a healthy amount of time for a walk. So I'm like, oh, this is a little disappointing. The venue itself was a different kind of venue where there was no, it's not a hotel, there was no lobby, there was no area where they were going to be running the TV. It was a very small, intimate, nice venue. The wedding ends at, it was a very quick ceremony, very nice, very quick. They had a great cocktail hour. But during the cocktail hour, and this was the biggest surprise of, one of my biggest surprises of my life, is the bride, I told you, was a massive Leaf fan. So was her husband. And I sort of thought, okay, they're going to mix this into somehow be something, right? Buzzes, the bride says, do not put the Leafs game on. I do not.
She wanted to watch it hungover in her bed the next morning.
I have no idea, but the buzz was out. The buzz was buzzing. And I'm kind of looking around, and the buzz is obviously all coming to me, right? Like, I know that I'm going to be public offender number one at this wedding. And the groom comes up to me, and again, he's a huge Leaf fan, and he's starting to do the don't do anything with the Leafs game, wink, wink, like, put on the Leafs game. You be the one that puts it on. I'm like, okay, no, I'm like, I'm certainly not going to be this person. But I had to be that person just to a certain degree. Like, I did the scouting report. The dinner started, like, right as the Leafs game was starting. And it's all the speeches. I, by the way, I don't know how you guys are with wedding speeches. I get mega emotional. Like, I'm just the choke back tears guy all the way through. When people say they don't cry at weddings, I'm like, you are steel. You have stone heart. I don't know how it's possible. When family members go up there, they start telling stories. Oh, obviously, God. It's like, I have connections to these people all the way back to university. They're telling tales. It's just, I'm all choked up. Parents, you know, when parents go up there and tell their things, I'm a mess. I can barely focus.
This is good to know, because you're my target. I've done a handful of wedding speeches, and it's always, you got to find someone, and you're like, that's the person I'm going to make cry. And then you know you've done a good job. As long as one person's teared up, you're the target.
Yeah, I tear up, kid. Like, and I was good because I had my back to the table from where I was sitting. And the whole time during some of the speeches, I was like, I'm so glad none of the fellas can see me cry. It's just doing the get rid of the tears. But I had the Leafs game running in my pocket on, you know, good old Rogers Ignite. What a seamless stream it was. Great. Just a great product on your phone. I'm watching the Leafs, and I'm trying to not be distracting in between the speeches, right? I'm at the table. I feel like it's kind of fair. But people at the table can notice, like, I'm a chatty Cathy. I'm just staring down at my own lap.
You?
Yeah. Yeah. I was out of a chat. I'm staring down at my own lap, and I'm looking at it. And now this is the fear, is that you draw the crowd, right? Is that people are looking to me for the Leafs score. And then people start asking me for Leafs score. People start asking me to prop up a phone. I'm like, no. I laid the phone flat on my table, and that was it. And I said, no one come over here. Stream it on your own phone. I basically watched little bits and pieces and throughout the wedding. And then there was a breaking point, though, once the game started to get pretty exciting and then the speeches started to wrap up. It was the third period. And then you start to see, like, every single table start to, like, pop out the phones and watch the last 10 minutes or so of the third with, like, audible groans, but it's all different people on all different phones with, like, slightly different streams speeds. Like, I had a whole group huddled around me or near the bar, and there was another guy who had a phone, and his thing is slightly behind, and his friends are yelling at him to turn it off and just huddle around me. So it was great because they win, right? They win, and it's the last minute. There's that huge save that Jack Campbell makes on the power play against Steven Stamkos, where I was convinced on my little tiny phone screen that it was going to show a review that puck was in the net. Like, that was one of the shocks of my lifetime that puck did not go in the net. They made up for it because Stamkos' first shot of the very next game was a softie that goes in over Jack Campbell's shoulder. I'm like, oh, that's the universe balancing itself out. But either way, it was really fun. It was really great. I didn't get to pull off the double thing. I got so many messages asking me that I'm disappointed that I didn't just ruin my friend's wedding by being a complete jerk and blowing out of the scene and doing the double dip. Like, because of the amount of expectation I had.
Here's what we do at 9:56 today, though. Uh-huh. You take all those messages, put them together. We take this five-minute block here. We go to the bosses and say, Sportsnet now. You need additional programming? You need something on Sportsnet 360 to air after the Will Lou show or whatever, after Kipper and Bourne? Let's film this pilot. Let's get it going.
I'll be honest, though. There was really no moment where I could have gone. Also, where I was sitting at a table, I got shouted out in, like, it would have been pretty hilarious because I got shouted out in the speeches, and
then you're not there.
Yeah, I was the only way you
could cover is, like, someone could be like, JD's really emotional. He's just in the bathroom. Like, this is hard on him. It's just so emotional.
Yeah,
it's
really hard on him.
Hard on him. Yeah, that's
he was
not
in love with the bride.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Ailish, you're never running my PR. It was hard on him at a wedding is not a good look. Like, that is not a good look.
So in love with love.
So lonely.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the wedding, and this is what I realized at the wedding, is that plan is awesome if you're a peripheral figure at a large wedding. If you're a peripheral figure at a large wedding, you can pull that off in every single way. But when it's a small wedding, which this was, perfect size. I think that, okay, that pandemic thing that's happened here, who's still having massive weddings? Like, my other friend went to one on Sunday that he said was almost 350 people.
No,
and I went,
way.
Yeah, and I went, and he got invited to this wedding, and I go, who are these people? And he's like, oh, we barely know them. And I'm like, what?
They must have lots of money.
Yeah,
for them.
No, duh. But that's the thing, though, too, is, all right, even if you do have lots of money, why are you inflating your numbers? It's just like, I've now been to a wedding that was 50 people that I thought was going to be aggressively small and not workable whatsoever, and it was great. You got to hang out with every single person at the wedding. This one was a little over 100, and still, it felt like, when you looked at it from the outside, you'd have been like, oh, that looks like a pretty small wedding. But once you were inside the venue, like, everything was intimate, good, fun. Everybody got to speak with everybody. It was just great. It was really, really great. Pandemic, nothing really good except for rejuvenating and revitalizing weddings. But yeah, I didn't get to do the double dip. I'm sorry to the people that I let down for not double dipping. I did, however, watch the game, and then I watched it Saturday. Many thoughts. Okay, so yesterday's disappointment. I think we have to start with yesterday's disappointment, because there's no way on balance you could be feeling good unless you're the head coach, Sheldon Keefe, who got really criticized for these comments that I'm about to roll here. And I want to know what you guys think about them and whether the criticism is fair. Roll it, Josh.
Came on the road here. We got a split. We came out here. It was a best of five series with three games in this building and two at home. Now it's a best of three with two in our building. So it's a successful road trip in that sense. Whether you lose the game 2-1 or in the manner that we did tonight, it doesn't matter. You wash it. You move on. We'll be better next time. We just believe in our team. We believe in our team all series, all season. You know, we've played well against this team. We've responded well the last time. We, you know, coming off a loss, that's the type of series that it's been. We're going back home, and you know, we have to be better, and we will be.
So, a successful road trip. Yeah, there's four far.
Yeah, no. Technically, you know, he's right. If you're going back home and it's a best of three series, that is technically the right information. I do not think that I would like my head coach to be saying that after you get blown out. Different story if it's a tight game and you played well and everybody showed up. But it is the opposite of what happened last night. Yeah, it's just, it's not the greatest type of mentality. You know, I think that maybe he's looking for a silver lining, but it's hard to see that, especially historically. The Leafs haven't been great at closing out series, whether they're up 3-1 or not. You know, they haven't been great in the finale of a playoff series. So if it's a twisted JD logic of reverse psychology, reverse jinxing, then he did a good job. But you need to be using, I think, the bullet that we've talked about in the past that Sheldon Keefe is good at doing, where you say, that was a disgrace and we need to do better and we need every single person to show up except for Shalgren, who was the best player in the Maple Leafs last night. So don't love the message. Think that I was a little bit surprised personally. Maybe it's just the player in me that I would be questioning why my coach went that direction, but we'll see if it works with the reverse positivity.
It's not just the player in you. And maybe if these games, the order were reversed, I could see you spinning it that way to try to build some momentum and positivity. There is no way to frame this, I don't think, other than a squandered opportunity, right? Where you give up one at home, you get it back immediately. Your goal should no longer be get home with a 2-2 series. It should be get home with two chances to close this thing out. And yeah, it's a tough series. Tampa Bay's a good team. You're probably not going to go into every game expecting to win every single time. But that was a terrible, terrible performance. Like, it very much felt like, and I know this isn't the case, but it felt like Keefe gave that speech before the game. And the Leafs were like, okay, we got our one on the road. Like, let's pack it up. It's funny to contrast the two. And I had a lot of Leaf fans digging up a tweet of mine from 2019 where Kawhi did the Nick Nurse says, okay, let's go there and get one and then come back home. And Kawhi says, "F it, let's get two." That was getting a lot of play after Friday's game, and the Leafs did the opposite. It was like, "No, we got our one." Mm-hmm. And so I don't really know, especially right after the game. I mean, kudos to him, I guess, for having a level head, but that screams missed opportunity to me. And yeah, I don't know how you spin that as a, this is a good outcome when you had every chance to take full control of the series.
So I'm going to try to keep a level head too. One is, I understand that he's not going to try to bury his team, and that's part of the element here, right? Is you don't want Sheldon Keefe to just go up there and start going, making it seem as though that was the series. He's got to try to keep his team engaged in that, hey, the past is the past. So we're just going to spin this as we still did win one of these two games, and that was initially the bare minimum goal. But you're right. The way they to see them come out that way, where just no one showed up. No one showed up. That was a horrific game. I had friends texting me blaming certain players. Like, everyone was mad at either Justin Hall or then John Tavares or then William Nylander and Jack Campbell. And I'm getting all these kind of revolving texts from people going, this is my whipping boy of the game. And I went, how could you possibly? How could you possibly?
You can't pick. Because
they were all so bad. There was not one player in that game who played well. There wasn't. There were guys who had little moments where they made nice plays, but a good game? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Dreadful. Dreadful, dreadful, dreadful. Didn't show up on time, didn't have any fight once you ended up getting pushed down, and just showed no resolve whatsoever. Like, just truly, truly bad. So Keith goes to the podium, and he has those words, and he talks about successful road trip. We nitpick these things, and I think we're nitpicking a little bit too much the way that he's describing it. I will say this, though, Blake. I give a lot of credence to what you're saying, which is, where's the attitude of let's get two? I understand a coach saying that retroactively, but where's the Leafs player that went into this thing and said, let's get two? And that was what was so frustrating to me last night, is the Leafs have won playoff games in the first round. It's never been, oh, this team has been swept in every single playoff series. It's no, the Leafs haven't won a first round series since Blake and I were in high school. And Ailish was literally like, I don't know, in a jungle gym. Like, I don't know what you were doing when the Leafs last won. We have seen them win games. We have seen them blow opportunities to close series. They were up on the Montreal Canadiens. What did they not do? They didn't close the series. Mm-hmm. What did Kyle Dubas say that they wanted from this season? Killer instinct. That was the buzzword. We want killer instinct come playoff time. You were up against the Boston Bruins. People forget that the last time that they played that. They were up. They had a chance to close it at home. They didn't close. No killer instinct. Nothing. No push from the forwards. No push from the stars. Now you end up in a situation where you're on the road in Tampa Bay, and you go up 3-1, and it's very likely lights out. I know that you can't say it is lights out because you blew a 3-1 lead last year to a far inferior team, so you don't get the benefit of that doubt. But you had a real chance to step on their throats. And what happens? You lay a monster egg. And so if you're a Leafs fan or you're a Leafs commentator or you're, whatever you are, in the Leafs orbit, a Leafs hater, you look at this and you say, boy, here we go again. And I have a tough time. And this next game, great. They're evened up in the series. If the Leafs win that game, awesome. But to have faith that they're going to be able to have that moment where they close out a series, where they bring their very best game into a place where, well, now it needs to happen right now. Now it needs to happen today. That has yet to be proven with these guys. They've yet to do that. And that's their biggest issue. That's their biggest flaw. They've shown up for playoff games. Everyone now has had playoff moments. It's obviously worse in this series for certain players. But when are these guys ever going to prove they can step on somebody's throat? And to be honest, you're not going to find that out in the next game. You're not going to find that out in game six, potentially, unless they they win and they have the opportunity to close. Like, that's what they have to prove. Can you actually put a team away? Can you actually show up when you have that opportunity?
Well, this is now they've put themselves in the prime opportunity to show that either things have changed or things have not changed. If the players
have
matured,
but that was the opportunity yesterday too.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, that's a very bad perspective of how you know, like if we're judging now, it's like, as we said, well, it feels like things are sliding, right? Well, they've now have three games to win two games. And this is an opportunity where we can see if the growth, if the mental fortitude is something that they discovered this year. It's backs against the wall. And what I thought was interesting is the team with the most pressure has won each of the four games. Leafs had the most pressure, I think, game one to start the series, right? Then Tampa has the most pressure to tie it up. Leafs are, okay, let's take the lead. They win. Now Tampa's back home. They win. So it's just like, I think the team that has that mentality coming in as like, we gotta prove ourselves has won each game. So maybe that bodes well. If you're looking at the Leafs, they have a lot of pressure come Tuesday to tie the series up. If this series is going to go traditionally how it has over the last four games, that could be a positive for you. But it's all going to come down to having to wash that away and find a way that what Tampa did after game one to respond. Tampa has consistently won the game after a loss for 16 straight times. So they're good at that. Are the Leafs good at that? Well, we're going to have to see if there is growth this season or if it was just a blip that they had the best regular season of their lives.
And you're right, that game five is probably going to be the most telling game in terms of that. But I have trouble after game four not thinking nothing's changed, where, again, mm-hmm. you have the chance to show that killer instinct that JD mentioned or Dubas mentioned and take control of a series. And it'd be one thing if you played a really good game or a really tight game and came up short, right? But 8 minutes in, this game was over. And yeah, they found some punch back in the third, whatever.
No, they didn't. That punch back, no, I know. Was not anything.
Fake.
Honest to God, that was the fakest thing ever.
It was the most Raptors thing the Leafs could do.
I couldn't wait for that to be, like, honestly, William Nylander might have been their worst player. Like, if you want to see a guy who dogged it in a game, is
that play late in the second period, where there's a chance to gain the offensive zone and he's skating in the right corner and he just completely gives up on it. Like, the most fitting thing of that entire game is him getting two goals in the part of the game that absolutely doesn't matter. And we've turned it over to the score effect monster. It was perfect. And it was very, very predictable that he'd be the guy that gets the cheapies the second one wasn't a cheapie. That was a great goal, but it didn't matter at all. So yeah, I'm pretty discouraged after game four. And yes, they could take two or three at Tampa Bay. They did it over the first three games of the season. They did it over a chunk of the regular season series. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but we're looking at a situation where the Leafs could have come back with everything in their favor and all the opportunity in the world to change things. And now it's, it's best two out of three, and these teams are pretty evenly matched, and it's a coin flip. And yeah, well, you had a chance at one of those dummy coins where it's heads on both sides, and you were like, no. Let's use the fair coin. Let's go down to the wire here. And it's really, even if they win this series, it's disappointing. Like, let's say they win this series still and they're making a playoff run. Like, we're going to be looking back at this a week or two from now and saying, well, it would have been nice if you could have closed out that series quicker so that Jake Muzzin hasn't played 14 games in 27 days or something like that. And that's putting the cart before the horse. It's getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, I'm not worried about any of that stuff. Like, just win the series.
I'm just saying, even if you win this series still, there is a cost to blowing these games. Mm-hmm. And for me, the cost is just like, I don't know how you look at yourselves. And this has happened. Let's not forget, too, that game two followed a fairly similar script. This is twice in the series now. They've kind of come out pretty flat. And it wasn't as extreme in game two, but it wasn't a super competitive start to game two either. Mm-mm. It's hard to look at that and be like, oh yeah, this team is different. That rot that has been there for 5 years, and no matter what pieces you change, it seems to still be there.
Yeah.
It's hard to expect that that's gone after the performances in game two and game four.
Well, that's why, respectfully, I disagree with your thing about who had the most pressure won, Ailish. I think that just the Leafs have the most pressure on them, and that game was way more pressure on the Leafs than it was on Tampa. Like, yeah, Tampa needed to win it more to even the series, but Toronto is the team that has all the pressure on their shoulders. They don't have back-to-back Stanley Cups, and they haven't proven anything yet. And again, this was an opportunity to show that killer instinct off, and they didn't have it. John Tavares and William Nylander had done nothing in the series. And yesterday they did nothing either. Like, those are the most useless points in the history of points. And they didn't show up. They were both dreadful. Truly, truly awful. Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews got barbecued last year for not being able to show up in the postseason. And they played with no force and no impact. Their blue line looked old and slow. Their goaltender let in bad save after or bad goal after bad goal. Like, what are the stops that Jack Campbell made in that game? Like, they did all this parading of how great Jack Campbell was after game three. He made that great stop, and John Cooper got criticized for saying, yeah, we'll take that save percentage all day. And guess what? Mm-hmm. He looked pretty Jack Campbell in January, Jack Campbell, than he did Jack Campbell Vezina version that showed up to start the season in that hockey game. Like, there was nothing that you could really point to. And this is sort of the scary thing at this point. You look at this series on a balance, and Blake, you mentioned it, that two of these games are all kind of like pretty wonky, that the only game that was really, really a close, tight, checked game ended up actually being the third game of the series. But if you go across the board right now and you look at the numbers, the nerd numbers, the ones that everybody likes to mock, they tell you a pretty clear picture of Toronto not being as good of a team 5-on-5. Like, they tell you a pretty definitive picture. Like, you go look at Corsi 4. You go look at goals, like goals 4 percentage. You go look at pretty much, again, go across the board. Go look at scoring chances, scoring chance percentages, high danger chance percentages. Like, none of these things really tell a story of Toronto's dominance. And this is kind of the spookiest thing to me, and this is why the killer instinct thing is now back on the shoulders of Auston Matthews, Mitch Marner, John Tavares, and William Nylander. The Leafs built this team. Kyle Dubas's vision of this team was that Toronto would have a dominant four forwards that would be able to carry play and kill it at 5-on-5, right? Guess how many of the Leafs 5-on-5 have, and I know some people are going to recoil at hearing these things, but yeah, have the positive shot percentage 5-on-5.
Just the third line, right? The Camp Engvall line?
Well, let me tell you this right now. After last night, zero of the top four guys have that. Zero. Auston Matthews, 41% of the shot share when he's on the ice. He's getting 88% of his zone starts in the offensive zone in this series. 88. Like, where's the force? I think Mitch Marner has actually looked pretty great. Like, eye test-wise, Marner, to me, has been their best forward throughout this series, especially when you factor in just his role on special teams and the penalty killing and just that. We've seen Mitch Marner look lost in the playoffs. That was last year. He doesn't look like a lost soul to me. The biggest story to me is, okay, sure, John Tavares hasn't looked great. William Nylander hasn't looked great. Those guys need to be better. They need to provide secondary scoring. But Auston Matthews has not looked right. He scored those two goals in the first game and has not had one since. He had some
good moments. Doesn't kill penalties, but that's an excuse for maybe one game. But, like, you can't let that become something that's, it's something I'm going to lean on for four games. Like, find a way into the series.
I'm just saying, you go across the board with Auston Matthews' numbers, and it shows you a picture of a guy who is, again, the greatest 5-on-5 goal scorer since he came into the league. And there has not been he has not been a positive 5-on-5 player in the series. Like, it just has not happened despite a lot of advantages going his way. And in this series, where now the last two games, Tampa had last change, Auston Matthews sort of went away. And there were moments in that game where I went, is he hurt? And that's not good. Like, because it tells you one of two things.
It's like he didn't want to shoot on the power play. It's like he didn't want to control the puck. And then that was the exact same feeling I had. I was like, is his wrist hurting? Like, what are we doing here? Why are you not controlling the play? It looked like he was shying away from the moment. That's not a great feeling.
This is something I want to ask Bourne about when we have him on at 8 o'clock later, because one of the things I noted early in the series was that Tampa Bay was defending Auston Matthews on the power play differently than teams have historically done it. They were sending two to him, so there's one on his body and one in his immediate passing lane. And it looked like the Leafs and Spencer Carberry have tried to tweak their power play a little bit to free Matthews up and use him differently. And it looks uncomfortable for him. He doesn't, like, he looks out of place.
And he looks frustrated. He spent two minutes on the power play.
Yeah, and he doesn't look dangerous. So you're right, JD. All those, like, credit to Sheldon Keefe for still finding a way, even on the road, to get Matthews and Marner out there in advantageous situations. But this is three games in a row now that he's started the lion's share of his shifts in the offensive zone, and only in one of those did he win the possession battle. The pure volume of shot attempts his lines are creating have gone down, down, down over the last three games. That was as passive as we've seen Auston Matthews this year. It's you know, I'm curious as to Bourne's take as to whether they could be doing more tactically to free him up, if this is Tampa doing a good job. But it's very, very rare for, like, Austin Matthews played 10 minutes at 5-on-5 last night, and his line had 5 shot attempts. Like, not 5 shots, 5 anything thrown at the net in 10 minutes, and almost every one of those shifts started in the neutral zone or the offensive zone.
Again, yesterday's game tilted that, like, tilts those numbers in a place where they all go across the board and look bad. But in the series now, his line has generated 8 high-danger chances for 5-on-5, and they've had 9 high-danger chances against 5-on-5. And this is a group that, once again, is starting 88, almost 89% of their offensive zone draws, of their starts in the offensive zone.
And how much did we talk about rush chances coming into this series, right? It's one thing, obviously, you can't get a rush chance if you start in the offensive zone. You've already got the zone. But, hey, when play's tilting the other way to that extreme and Tampa's having as much success as they are, and I know Matthews has only been on the ice for 1 5-on-5 goal against, so it's not resulting in goals allowed necessarily, but this is very uncharacteristic of that line to be on the wrong end of the ice tilting. But it's and JD, you mentioned that some of these stats are tilted because the way the series has gone, but guess what, the offensive zone starts and all that stuff, that's helpful over 82 games that are noisy and random. But here, that all that tells us is, if he's the only one getting all the offensive zone starts, all that tells us is that the Leafs are spending a lot of time in their defensive zone. So that's probably on them for losing the zone so frequently.
I guess where I'm at with this right now is, you do have the opportunity, Ailish outline, right? You've got still an opportunity to close this thing out. You're not behind in the series. You still now have home ice advantage, where you're going to have 2 games where you can dictate the matchups. You've had moments in this series where you've really looked like the better team. But the biggest positivity so far out of this series, I would say, has been Mitch Marner's play. Mm-hmm. The blue line at times has looked very physical, which has been good. Like, they can really hold up to getting the front of the net clear. And I've really enjoyed that. And this third line, the Engvall, Kampf, Mikheyev, that those 3 guys have just been able to really impose themselves. But it has been more counterpunch opportunities, not like going down and dominating in the offensive zone opportunities. It's been big counterpunches of those guys being on the ice. Leafs need to show that they can dominate this team, or at least have stronger stretches of offensive play. And that is the big story of this series so far. Again, what is the core principle of this team? 4 forwards that are better than any other team in the NHL's 4 forwards. They have to be that because they're paid like that. And I don't care about retroactively what could have been and what should have been with other contracts. That's the way it is. Tavares makes $11 million. He has never looked like an $11 million player in the series. William Nylander, his contract is great. Well, he has looked he's looked poor in this series. Marner has been, I would say, solid. Matthews, though, is not the 60-goal scorer that we've seen in the regular season so far. They have not dominated. They have not imposed their will for really any stretches against Tampa Bay 5-on-5. It has never really felt for long stretches like, boy, they have the best 4 forwards. Have you felt like, boy, they're just discernibly better than Point, who just refuses to go? Like, Point, you notice every single shift. Point is just nonstop every single shift.
I thought there was a great moment that highlighted the contrast in the forward groups, where in the third period, I think at that point it's 6-3 or something, and Point really gets into it with Riley, I think. And that was more
Well, that was awful, though. He almost ended Riley's career.
Yeah, that it was bad, but Point being that fired up with a 3-goal lead late in a game they've already won, and where was that from any of the Leafs at any point in that game? I know it's just a snapshot or whatever, but Braden Point's been a great example all series, I thought, of, even though he only has 2 points, hey, how are you impacting the game? How are you changing this series? Totally. What are you doing to drive play and drive the kind of intensity? And, you know, I don't think the Leafs have got that from their top guys. And Point's not scoring. It's not like he's just doing it on the score sheet. Even like Kucherov has 5 points, but he hasn't really been dominant offensively.
No, Kucherov has been their worst forward 5-on-5, essentially, out of the entire group. And that's it, right? It's like, when I talk about, hey, 4 forwards versus 4 forwards, you don't even need to throw Kucherov into the mix for Tampa. Right now in this series, you'd be going Braden Point, Alex Killorn. Like Anthony Cirelli has been phenomenal
their
for them.
Major shutdown line. Like, who has done so much against the top Leafs.
Their fourth line has so dramatically outplayed So, the Leafs lower lines. And I know that that's a luxury that Tampa has. Like, that fourth line being as good as it is kind of the product of the LTIR shenanigans, but still.
Even still, it's hard to pick out who Tampa's best four forwards have been in this series because they've gotten contributions all over their lineup. And now when you're looking at these two teams, and we have four games of sample, you have to look at it and go, Toronto has won their games. The first one in the series, Tampa didn't show up. They weren't there on time. It was the question of the burnout thing. Since then, it's been pretty heavily tilted in Tampa's favor. And you go across and you say, right now, you know that the Leafs have a better save percentage than Tampa in this series? Like, you know they have a higher PDO than Tampa in this series? Like, there's not a lot of indicators that would be telling you that Toronto is the better team, which is something that I really felt through the first two games of this series, where I went, man, Toronto really blew that one. They just, they got a bad bounce, and it was a tough break, and they got a couple of them, and there was those bad penalties, and if they don't give up those power plays, what does that series look like? But kind of from that point forward, Tampa Bay has looked better. 5-on-5, they're the better team. And so no wonder why you see John Cooper going, I'm tired of the parade to the penalty box, because if this thing stays 5-on-5, something has to change pretty dramatically from the Leafs' top four players in order for them to be the best team in the series.
If you were to tell me coming into the series that Andrei Vasilevsky would have a worse save percentage than Jack Campbell, I would say, well, the Leafs should be winning every single game. They should be outplaying, and their top players should be scoring. The fact that that number one goalie in the universe, that, you know, regular season and stats is a non-factor right now in the series is the biggest concern in my books. And that's because yeah,
you haven't got goalied once.
Exactly. And that's the Blake loves the goal getting goalied stats, and they don't have it lately.
Listen, I don't want to be overly negative here because, again, the Leafs have had moments. They've had just really nice play from that third line. They've shown some resiliency in the way that they've come out to start the series in game one and the series and the response in game three on the road. And that was a very nice win, game three. Again, coming off the weekend. Jack has made some big stops, but overall in the series on balance now, I would say that it's been pretty mediocre to not, you know, he made that one big save, essentially.
Fine.
Made two big saves because he also made the toe save.
I thought he was really solid in game three.
Yeah, in game three.
But otherwise, I mean, you're looking at an .890 save percentage through four games.
I just mean the blue line has had – yesterday was tough for all of them involved. Like, every single player involved had a brain fart or got killed in transition or something happened to them yesterday. Like, yesterday they looked slow. But I mentioned that they had looked physical and it had looked more like a playoff blue line. But – They got to figure out a way to be better than what they've been, even through these first four games. Like, they have to figure out a way to be better. And this is where you start to get spooked about ghosts, and that's why you can't really spin this as a positive, because you haven't won. You're not tested in a way where you've proven that you can overcome these moments or that those are blips, like the way that Tampa can when they lose a game. And they look around and their coach says, that game one was about us, not them. And then they come back and they win those ones. You go, yeah, because you have that track record. You have that history. This is it. If you're going to prove you have killer instinct, it's going to end up happening right now because you've never put a team away and it needs to happen immediately. Let's take a break. Let's come back. Let's try to feel a little bitter with the A-list. By the way, you can always send text. Tomorrow's text line Tuesday, 590-590, but follow on Twitter and on Instagram at JD Bunkus, at A-list4far, and at E. Blake Murphy. You can always fire messages away. We'll end up doing more fan interaction tomorrow when we're setting this sucker up, but we always like to hear from you and sprinkle them out throughout the show. The A-list, that's next on the Fan Morning Show.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morning show, 4590 The Fan. JD, Blake, and Ailish. other than our Toronto Maple Leafs and Toronto Blue Jays. Lots of fun sports this past weekend. We'll get into that a little bit later. You know, we're the number one F1 show in the universe. Got a little UFC, a little NBA roundup. But something incredible that happened, that's in the A-list. Let's roll it.
Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
Before we get into what related to that intro song, I'm going to sneak a pretty cool thing that I found on the internet. And there's a 16-year-old high school sophomore from Bloomington who just shot 80 at a local U.S. Open qualifier. That's pretty cool. But the best part of this is his name is Happy Gilmore. His legitimate given name at birth, Happy Gilmore. He has his own website, teamhappygilmore.com, where you can go look and you can follow along with his tournament schedule, his scores, and a little bit about him, where I learned that his favorite restaurant is Olive Garden. His favorite meal is steak, which I hope you're not getting at Olive Garden. And non-surprisingly, his favorite movie, Happy Gilmore.
So, if he was a true Happy Gilmore super fan, his favorite restaurant would be Subway sandwiches, though, because that's
true,
the whole,
that's true.
It's the whole bit.
Put it on
the
tee.
Yeah.
So, pretty incredible naming situation. And for the fact that he's a golfer, obviously isn't surprising. But my question is that a blessing or a curse for the rest of his young career? He's 16 years old. Curse. He's already kind of making a name for himself. Curse?
Yeah, it's an obvious curse. I don't know why parents do this, why they do the whole, we're going to turn our child's name into a gimmick thing. Like, it's a human. You've made a human. Why would you possibly think this is a good idea? So I'm sure the kid seems like he's doing all right from the 2-minute preamble I get that's designed specifically, a positive moment.
Like, he's not awful. No, he's
well,
he's good golfer for a 16-year-old.
Sure, I assume shot an 80. I don't know what he actually is, what his actual prospects are. But either way, the added attention of this is not out of, wow, that's a cool, thoughtful name. It's just lame, like, that you would do that. So, yeah, I think that it's, oh, Brolic says this is not his given name. Ailish.
Yeah, Landon James Gilmore, but he has adopted the name Happy.
That's very different.
Like a nickname.
I
That's
had no idea. Different.
But it's like his official name on like the U.S. Open is he's listed as Happy Gilmore. It's like Speedy Claxton in the NBA.
Okay, well then it's fine. Sure, then if he's a golfer and they've given him the nickname Happy Gilmore, like yeah, sure. Then that's
everywhere.
Fine.
Sorry, everywhere I read said that that was his real name. So I'm
because yeah, Landon James Gilmore is very different than Happy Gilmore. Naming him that. Like, I thought his parents gave him this name, and I was like, geez, guys, like, I get it. Like, you were so excited to do this. But no, for him to adopt it as his own thing and take it as his own brand, that's his choice, which is fine. It's cool. It's great. Good for him.
Yeah, I love it that way. That's why I was searching it out. I was like, if the parents named him Happy, like, Happy's not a great name anyway. Like, what if you are not a happy dude? Like, I feel like there's a lot of pressure on you to fake it.
That's how you would think about it.
Struggles.
That's how Blake would think about it with his, like, sad music. He's like, wow, what if I was not named Happy and I had to try to spin it like I listen to all my emo music? It wouldn't work very well. People would make fun of me.
And look, I don't have, like, a gimmick name like that, but my parents did a silly thing where they named me one thing and then called me another. So I would feel for this guy if that were the case. But, yeah, the whole adopting a second name and having it be your official name, I like that part of it.
Yeah, like, I like that too.
NBA players, there have been a handful of them over the years who've done that. It's great. Muggsy Bogues.
Yeah, you take your own name and you repurpose it and you go with what you like to be called. Absolutely. I just thought this kid was a named Happy, so that's different.
So did
what's
I.
Next? Yeah.
I honestly read like 4 articles about him, so I have no idea where I missed that one article, but cool. Let's move on. The most incredible Kentucky Derby of all time happened this weekend.
It was
kind of snuck up on us, but the story of the champion is absolutely incredible. The horse Rich Strike was added to the race 30 seconds before the deadline on Friday. He opened at 80-1 odds. Another horse was scratched last minute. He was added in. He wins the Kentucky Derby in the second biggest upset of all time, after somebody won in 1913 with 91-1 odds. So just a little bit of a edge on that one.
That must have been the most rigged.
That's 1913.
Yeah, like, oh man, let's look back at that. Somebody got screwed. All I'm going to say is that could not have been on the up and up.
If you haven't seen the video of this overhead view of the Kentucky Derby race, you must go find it immediately, because this guy is at the back of the pack. Rich Strike has no business being near the front. It's not even close. It is, even the commentator, it's a two-horse race, it's a two-horse race, and all of a sudden he's like, and Rich Strike is coming, and he wins. Like, it's just outstanding. One of the biggest shocking upsets in terms of sports as of lately, and it got me thinking of, you know, some of the most shocking upsets that you guys have seen or experienced. And that's a good text line question for people to text in. If you haven't had a chance to watch the Kentucky Derby, well, put that on top of your list. But where this ranks in some of the most shocking upsets that you've ever seen, that's my question to you guys.
Okay, well, I actually rank it low because it's still a horse race. And I don't think of it as sports. Let's just start with that. I don't think it's sports. I think it's sports adjacent. It's sporting. It's something along, but it's ultimately it's a horse race. And I've heard the spiel about jockeys and heart rates and blah blah blah. And I'm not here for it right now. This is not the athletic competition. Like, it's a shocking thing, but it's only shocking because what happened. We go, oh wow, 80-1. Like, we hear about it retroactively. It's not like going into a season where like a team had no hope. Or a game where a team had no hope, and then the shocking upset happened to me. To me, still, the standard bearer will always be Leicester City winning the Premiership. Mm-hmm. Because they were a bunch of nobody losers, and they won the Premiership in a league where there's no cap, and you have these mega clubs that they actually beat somehow. They didn't just sell off all their players. They went out and they did it. I can't remember what they were. It was far greater than an 80-1 shot. But that to me is still going to be the most shocking, even though I didn't follow the sport. I started following because of Leicester City, and every week you were kind of like, wow, these guys are really still doing this, huh? A one-off horse race, as surprising as it is, I would say, and as much as it will be referenced in the gambling world, especially come next Kentucky Derby, I wouldn't put it as one of the great shocks of my lifetime because I had no expectations going into the race, if that makes sense.
I believe Leicester City was 5,000-1.
Yeah.
So to give you an idea of the scale of that, 80-1 versus 5,000.
Like, you got to do that repeatedly, not just like in a one-off race. That was a brilliant. In terms of exciting races, though, Ailish, like, that's number one, no questions about it. Like, the way it was, the way it was called, the way the horse ran, the comeback, like, that was just I was blown away by how fun and exciting it was.
I need to know, though, how we're deciding which 20 horses make the Derby, that the replacement horse is good enough to outrun the other one. So either we've got 21 terrific horses, and it's the deepest field we've ever had.
He's not supposed to be good.
No.
He's supposed to, this is like, what I mean. He barely races these type of tracks.
How does this guy sneak through?
Even more outstanding.
I would say this, that the 80-1, and I think I saw that this horse may have even opened at 99-1, and that the odds came down a little bit, but that is just... It's insane that happened. You're right. Those are great points. There will probably be a movie on this horse someday.
I hope so.
Nobody's going to believe in you, Rich Strike. Rich Strike goes out and runs. I like when we make the horse a person, and that's going to be what happens in this story. But yeah, it was electric. But now people are going to lose their shirt in the next Kentucky Derby because everybody's going to bet the long shot, and everyone's going to have at least a little taste of
it. I would have bet just $5 on that. Just $5 if I had... I couldn't find it on some of the books when I was betting, or maybe I wasn't in time, but if I had seen... Rich Strike is also a good name, like Rich Strike. It's like, I like to bet the Kentucky Derby just based on the name.
In hindsight,
usually. It's more fun.
In hindsight, fun, this looks like the best name ever, and like, yeah, 100%. It's a great part of the story.
A tiny little... I guess there's restrictions on horse betting. That's what Blake says. Interesting. So, tiny little additional story about that. The trainer, Eric Reed, he lost 23 horses in a fire in 2016 and almost stopped, with his career because of how devastating that was. So, a little bit of added feel good about how, you know, he overcame the devastation and won. And congratulations. I think he won like $1.5 million because of this, and obviously has all the fame and really incredible. I'm sure we'll be playing that. And I thought it was funny that they kept using it as in the broadcast for every single sport yesterday, of how Rich Strike is just like Ilya Mikheyev this season, and Rich Strike is just like how, you know, Kampf has come up from nowhere and now is leading the race. So you're going to hear a lot of Rich Strike moving forward.
Yeah, the Leafs are down 5-0. If Rich Strike can do it,
the Leafs can do it.
Trying to do the 3-0's the most dangerous lead in hockey. Oh, Rich Strike being down 10 paces in the final stretch is the most dangerous lead in horse racing.
I like that.
Well, one thing that was not as exciting was the Jays weekend. We're going to get into that after the break. It's a Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.